morning. Welcome to the Bell and Pollock Legal Show. Brad Pollock and Bob Leonard in studio today to talk to you about any legal topic. You can call us at 303-713-8255. We've been doing this show for at least the last 15 years. Sometimes you just lose track over time. Coming in here every Saturday morning to field your questions that you have with respect to legal matters. We'll tell you the same thing. We will answer them the best we can while we're on the air. And a lot of times, most of the time, we take your name, we take your number, and we arrange for a lawyer or for one of us to call you off the air to discuss your case in more depth, to help you with what we can do, to get, make sure you get some extra information, some extra advice, maybe help you get down that road a little bit. You can call us at 303-713-8255. Gary Bell's out of town, so Bob's batting cleanup for us to do a little bit of work with us and be able to address your legal matters. It can be over a family law matter. It can be over what might be going on in your life with respect to any event that's happening where you might need a little advice and you've wondered, hey, I wish I could contact a lawyer and talk to him about what's going on. In our everyday legal life, we are personal injury lawyers. As personal injury lawyers, we handle people who've been hurt as a result of the negligence or carelessness of another. And we try to get full compensation for the injured person. If you have a situation where that has occurred, call us at 303-795-5900. You can always call here too, and we'll start you down the road. But our office number is 303-795-5900. You can also contact us through the website, bellpollock.com, or championsofthepeople.com. Bob, how are you doing today?
Good, Brad. Hey, Brad, when I was driving in, I heard something on the radio about this Equifax settlement. Did you hear about that?
Yeah. There's been a lot of money dedicated to what they think will be a settlement that's going to be completed. It's going to be ranging for hundreds of millions of dollars to be paid to you, the consumer. There's going to be different things that you can apply for and file a claim for. You can go to the Equifax data breach settlement website to learn something about what you may or may not be able to settle for and what might be available. But and it may sound like small amounts. It may sound like small things that they're doing, but they're important things. For any of you who have had your credit breached, it's important. You're going to want to know what's going on if you're eligible. If you have, at a minimum, you should be getting the free credit monitoring services. Or if you already have the credit monitoring services, you may be able to request $125 in a cash payment. Once again, it doesn't sound like much, but it's money that you're entitled to and you probably want to take a look at.
You know, it affected over 147 million people. And the settlement is about $425 million. So that's spread out a lot of people. May not, like you said, may not seem like a whole lot of money, but $425 million to help you resolve this issue, I think, is a good start.
Right. You know, it starts out with the monitoring. You can get at least 4 years of three bureau credit monitoring, which is a pretty good idea. You want to have your credit monitored. They talk about a lot of times that you can freeze your credit and then unfreeze it when you want to make a purchase or you want to do something. For many of you, that's probably the best thing to do is just call up and freeze your credit. But also, I think the credit monitoring is a good idea. If you already have the credit monitoring, you continue for at least 6 months more. You may be eligible for the cash payout. It's a good idea to get onto the, unfortunately, to even determine if you're eligible, you have to get on the Equifax website, and you're going to have to enter in some information, including the last six digits of your Social Security number. You're going, wait a minute, these are the people who are breached, and now I'm having to give them my Social Security number, last six digits. So I have to give them personal information. They probably already have it, and this is going to get you involved in the monitoring system. Once again, when you get on there, and this takes calling each one of the separate monitoring entities. There's three major ones. You want to freeze your credit. And like I said, and then when you go for a loan or you're going to go for some kind of transaction, you want to unfreeze it. Now, how does that help you if you're standing at the counter and you get one of those things where, a Target or one of those other places, they say, hey, Would you like to open up a Target credit card and we'll take 30% off your purchases here? And you're thinking, well, that might not be a bad idea, especially if you've purchased a lot of stuff or you're about to, and you're going, okay, I can get 30% off, but now you have to unfreeze your credit.
You know, Brad, I always keep a freeze in my credit just because that way no one can open any accounts. If someone went to the bank and tried to steal your identity to open a bank account, they can't do it. Recently, looking at purchasing a car, they couldn't check credit until I had to call up the credit bureau, went online, and unfroze it just for that day, and they were able to pull my credit, and then it went back and locked my credit history down after that.
These are real problems. These are real things you have to look at. You can call us at 303-713-8255 for any question you might have, a legal question. We're not a political show, although we do have we might end up talking a little bit about whether or not you can keep a sign in your front yard as a result of that's political in nature, or whether or not the town can make you give up that sign or get rid of it. But let's talk Equifax right now. I don't want to get into political. I do want to talk about freedom of speech at times and our First Amendment rights and whether or not we're entitled to exercise those rights or how would they get exercised. But right now, what we're talking about is Equifax. And the first thing you need to know is the deadline for filing is January 22nd of 2020. That sounds like a long ways off. It's not. That's very close. It's about 6 months. That's the deadline for filing for current losses in time. The deadline for future losses in time is out to January 22nd, 2024. But that first deadline is one that you probably need to You need to submit a claim in order to receive reimbursement for out-of-pocket losses and or time spent. You may claim out-of-pocket losses, time spent in credit monitoring services under the settlement. So I would encourage all of you to get onto the website. Yeah, we could be flooding the website, but get onto the website and get information about what's happening with respect to your legal rights and whether or not you can make a claim.
You know, also, if you were a minor, you get 18 years of credit monitoring. So if you have children, you might want to check your kids' credit history, too, because just because they're not adults, someone could hijack their credit history and be using it for some nefarious thing.
You've got to realize, you know, actually what we run into is everybody but the real perpetrators are actually paying for this breach. Equifax is paying for it. Now, they're somewhat of a bad guy in the whole scenario because, of course, they didn't have proper protections with the information they had. They're getting your personal information. They didn't have proper protections. But you had them in, and then you yourself are a victim of what's going on. You're paying a price for the breach. Equifax is paying a price for the breach. And it's all to deal with the real bad guys in the scenario, or the ones who are stealing your credit information and using it inappropriately. You're stealing your children's credit information and using it inappropriately, stealing credit, Social Security numbers, stealing all sorts of information. That's when you start realizing just exactly how bad it is, because they're stealing anybody's name, dates of birth, and Social Security numbers they can steal to use to their benefit. We're going to take a short break and call us at 303-713-8255 about any topic. We're here to answer your questions. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Bill and Polk Legal Show. Brad Pollock, Bob Leonard in the studio to talk to you today about any questions you might have about any legal topic, any legal matter that you need to talk about. We're here to help you know what's going on in your legal life and what you might need to know about. You can call us at 303-713-8255. There are files or lines open. So feel free to give us a call. If we can't answer your question, we'll find a way to answer it during the week, and we'll call you and give you an answer. Right now, we're going to go to Joseph on the line. Joseph, you have a question from Colorado Springs about a small claims question.
Yes. Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay.
Good.
I've got a question about small claims. I filed a small claims action against somebody for non-payment of rent and for damages.
All right.
They were on a month. They were on a month-to-month lease, and they just took up and left. When I submitted the claim, it was for approximately $3,500. What I forgot to do was deduct the amount of the security deposit that I retained.
Okay.
Is that going to be a problem, or do I just explain to the judge that I forgot to subtract that?
No, let's go over it a little bit. How much is the security deposit that was paid?
It was $900.
So that's going to take you $3,500 down to $900. That takes you to about $2,600 that your claim is for.
Yes.
When you go into small claims court now, small claims court is a court of general jurisdiction for $7,500. When you go in, the judge is going to ask you what your claim is and going to ask you how much you're requesting. You're going to have a chance to lay out for the judge your entire case, what you think you're entitled to, how much you think you're entitled to, why you think you're entitled to it. That's fine if you say, look, it was originally $3,500 for the damages. I've got this $900 security deposit that I properly accounted for. You did properly account for it, right, Joseph?
Yes, I sent them a letter. I sent the tenant the letter saying why I kept the security deposit.
Okay, and have they filed an answer as to why they don't think they should pay?
I don't know yet.
Okay.
I had them served 2 weeks ago.
Okay, so the court's going to set a date for you to come in and prove your case, and when you go in there, you can look at the court and say I've got the security deposit that I'm going to apply against the $3,500 for a total owing of $2,600 or whatever the amount is. You want to watch and see if the defendants try to claim that you're trying to cheat them or you're trying to cheat the court system by claiming the $900. But, Bob, what do you think? I think it's pretty easy if you just go in there and you show the court what you're doing.
I think, if you're upfront with the court and tell the judge exactly what happened, I think you'd probably be okay.
But
okay, good.
Here's the thing, Joseph. Make sure when you go to court, you're going to be doing a presentation. Now, I don't know if you need or if you, if the damage is one where you need or you want to bring a handyman in or somebody else in to say, I can verify these, or if you have any kind of proof where maybe they've given you estimates of what it's going to cost to repair or how you've determined the amount to repair. But
do they require
drafts and then receipts?
You what?
I took pictures, and then I also have receipts for expenses.
Oh, did you already get the work done to the place?
Yes.
Have you re-rented the place?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's good. See, and that's, the judge is going to like that. Most judges want you to mitigate. And that says that's where you lessen the degree of damages. Obviously, you could have been saying, look at my missed rent that I've got because I've had spend time getting this repaired. Instead, you went in, you got it repaired. So put together a book, a binder on different topics. The first thing is you want to, if you don't, did you have a written lease at all?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so, in the first part of it, do a written lease showing that they signed it, showing what the agreement was, showing how much they were supposed to pay. And obviously they're responsible for damages, less wear and tear. And then once you get that taken care of, you identify the lease and then go to the next step where you say, here's photos of the damages. That's what I would be doing anyway. I'd say I'd be showing the court on binder part number two. Here's the damages, and I do number three, saying here's the receipts that I had for repair and how I had to pay for it, and showing the total amount. And then I'd have probably a summary sheet where I'd be saying, in summary, here's the amount that I spent. getting this repair done based for these different things. You're going to want to be able to tell the judge that this is a reasonable amount to repair. You know, if it was a leaky faucet and it was $1,000 to correct the leaky faucet, the judge probably ain't going to buy it. But if it's a fair price for what was going on and what they did, and say, and here's what I got, and then you should be able to say, and then I deduct out their security deposit. Here's where I gave them a letter on the fact their security deposit needed to be applied against this. So you say the net amount I'm required, the total amount was $3,500 minus the $900. Here's the net amount.
You know, the easy part is getting the judgment or getting the court to give you a judgment. The hard part is actually enforcing the judgment.
Well, that's a good segue into a second question that I had. In the papers that the court gave me when I filed the action, it said that the prevailing party can collect as soon as the case is over. But obviously, you know, people don't come to court with a bunch of money in their pocket or their checkbook. How do you go about garnishing the person's wages or having them pay? Do you hand them paperwork right when the case is over, telling them to show me where they work at or what the bank accounts are? How do you go about that?
That's a good question, because what you're going to face is they're supposed to meet with you right after the judgment gets entered to discuss how they're going to pay the judgment. Normally what they do is they go storming out of the courtroom because they're mad and they don't want to talk to anybody and they don't talk to you.
There is a rule, rule, at least in the county court, 369, where you can actually bring them in, give them a set of questions and ask them where their bank accounts are, where they bank, where you can find the assets so you can actually try to recover.
Right, and there's a form they're supposed to fill out for small claims court in that same vein as far as telling you what it is they've got, what their assets are, and where they work. The main things you want to know about, and there's forms for writ of garnishment, and there's forms to exercise a writ against any money that's sitting in an account. One of the things you want to do, Joseph, is did they, when they paid the rent, did they pay by check?
Yeah, no, it was always by money order.
Okay, so you may not know where they're banking right now, and maybe they don't bank anywhere. Maybe they don't do that, so then you'd have to know where they were working. When they rented from you, did they give you any kind of list of references, or did they give you their employment information?
They didn't. It was very vague, and it's been a few years, and they've moved around a lot. I had to do a skip trace on them through a private investigator in order to find them.
Okay, so you may have some problems, and that's what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to find where they work and what they're doing so you can garnish. That's the first thing you want to do is see where you can garnish and see where they're working. So you may have to do some more investigative work. It sounds like you got a good investigator and you've got access to that. Normally, cost of collection lawsuit can be added on if you take that back to the court and ask them to add that onto the judgment. But you know, the bottom line is you need to you'll need to carry out some of those documents.
You know, you can garnish both their wages. I think it's 25%. I think of the wages you can garnish, and then if you can find their bank accounts, you can actually go to the bank with a certain type of writ and sweep their bank accounts and take all their money out of the account.
But would you recommend that I have this writ of garnishment ready before the trial, and then, you know, if I should prevail, just fill out the blanks and then hand it to them if they stick around?
Okay, the writ of garnishment doesn't
tell them to move it out.
The writ of garnishment doesn't go to them. You might have one ready and ask them to fill it out, but the writ of garnishment won't go to them. The writ of garnishment gets filled out and gets signed by a clerk that confirms the judgment, and then it gets served on their. And then you take your investigator and you have them serve that on their on the employer or whoever it is you're trying to get the money from. Anybody who owes money to your judgment debtors. you as a judgment creditor, you fill out the writ of garnishment, it gets filled out. What they're supposed to do is sit down with you and tell you where their assets are or how they're going to pay the judgment. And
so if the atmosphere between myself and the dependent is congenial to the extent that it can be, then it's okay to say, hey, you know, I've won the case. You owe the money. Would you please tell me where you work, where you bank, et cetera?
Right. Or, you know, you can start with saying, if it's congenial enough, you can start with saying, okay, you owe me $2,600. How do you want to pay it? And yeah. See how they want to pay it. And, you know, they may not want a writ of garnishment going to their employer or going to their bank. In a bank, you can wipe out their entire savings. You might say, do you have a way you want to pay this, or how do you want to do it? And they will, you know, hopefully they'll talk to you and give you an idea of what to do. You know, we've got to take a break. Joseph, you want to hang on, and we'll talk right after the break?
Okay.
Okay, hang on with us. We'll be right back, okay?
All right, thank you.
All right, you're listening to the Bell and Polk Legal Show. You can contact us at 303-713-8255. That's 303-713-8255. We'll talk to you about any legal topic. Give us a call. We've got a few lines open. We're happy to talk to you. We'll be right back.
Some kind of way out of here. Say the Joker to the thief.
Welcome back to the Bell and Polk Legal Show. Brad Pollock, Bob Leonard in the studio today. If you have a question, call us at 303-713-8255. We're going to talk to Joseph and complete his in just a minute. But first, we're going to talk to Eric and talk about eating. Eric, how's
Absolutely.
Breakfast today?
Got a lot to eat over here at Caitlin's. How you doing?
I'm doing well. You got a good breakfast for us today?
Absolutely, you know, and I'll start with the specials. We'll start with that breakfast special. We're going to go one more week. We're going to do $1 off of any omelet on the menu. Any omelet you want, you get $1 off. That will run all the way through next Friday, so be sure you can come and check that out. And we're doing $2 off of any lunch burrito, so you can get a carne adobada, a carne asada, a chicken, a steak burrito. Any of those are $2 off for those lunch burritos. That will also run through next Friday. And, guys, don't forget, every Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m., we do an early bird special. That gets two eggs, the hash browns, your choice of ham bacon or sausage on that plate as well. As always, you get the toast tortilla or the pancake option, and the pancakes are those buttermilk scratch-made pancakes that I always talk about on the show. So that's good to go. That is $6.99. That's every Monday through Friday from 6 to 10 a.m. Be sure and come check that out. We got tons of other scratch-made products on the menu, and we're trying a new thing. We're trying to put something on the menu. We're doing a pulled pork sandwich. We're going to put roasted red peppers and sauteed onions on that, some baby spinach and provolone. Put that on a hoagie roll. Of course, you can get our homemade chips or our waffle-cut fries on the side with that. Those are great accompaniments to that. That might end up on the menu, so come and check us out and give us your feedback, as always, any way you can on those options. And like I said, come check out all the other options we have. Tons of other scratch-made things, red chili, green chili, all kinds of other things on the menu to check out, guys.
That sounds great, Eric. How are the pancakes down there?
The pancakes are fantastic. Like I said, they're buttermilk. They're scratch-made. We do them right here. We do a variety of those. You can get Bananas Foster's pancakes. You can get peanut butter chocolate chip pancakes. We have raspberry, blueberry, banana pancakes, all kinds of stuff to check out. And we're actually doing a dessert special. This might be something you're interested in, Brad. We're doing a multicolored waffle. We're doing a Belgian waffle with some candied bacon and a scoop of ice cream on top. Now, I don't recommend that for breakfast or lunch, but you can get that on the side after your meal. Really, really tasty. We're trying that out. We don't do a lot of sweets down here, but we're trying something new. So come on down and check it out. You might want it.
Here's the problem with that, Eric. First of all, your meals fill me up anyway.
That's the thing. That is one thing. Our portions are a little bit large. That's true.
To have room for dessert is going to be really tough, but I'm going to give it my best shot here.
We'll bring on someone down and split it with somebody. Absolutely. You can do it that way, too.
I'll come on down tomorrow and see if I can't work that out.
Absolutely. And, guys, the flat screens are on. The sports are on. The umbrella's up. I think it's going to be another beautiful summer day here in Colorado. So please come down and check us out if you haven't done so already.
Tell us where you're located.
Guys, that's going to be 4379 East Mississippi Avenue. Now, that's one block east of Colorado Boulevard, and that is in the newly renovated Glendale Shopping Center. Guys, come on down. Check us out. You'll love it, every by the way.
Sounds great. I'll see you tomorrow, buddy.
Thanks, guys. You bet.
Take care. You listen to the Bell and Pollock Legal Show. Brad Pollock, Bob Leonard in studio, 303-713-8255. We've been talking to Joseph. Joseph is has a piece of property. He rented it out to some people. They've made some damage to it. He's got about $3,500 worth of damages. He's got a $900 security deposit, so he's going to go to a small claims court to get a judgment for his $2,600 that he's entitled to. We've talked about how he can present his case and what he can do. So now we're talking about if and when he gets a judgment, how you collect on a judgment. What do you do? Basically, to collect on a judgment, you have certain rights and remedies you can do. One is to lien property. A lot of times when you're dealing with renters, people who are just starting out in life or aren't paying or don't have real property, you can't really lien the property, any property, because there's no property to lien. Although, remember this, your judgment is good for, as I understand it, small claims court, it's the same as county court, and that's 6 years. And people's lives change. So, you know, it doesn't hurt to take a transcript of that judgment, Joseph, and go file it in the county court, or I'm sorry, in the clerk and recorder's office, so that in the event there's the ownership of any real property, that sometime down the future you have a chance that that's going to attach to the real property.
You know, Brad, go ahead, sorry.
You're saying if I get the judgment, file it with the clerk?
Right.
Doesn't that happen automatically?
No, the clerk of the court will have the judgment, and they'll do what's called a transcript of judgment. That's a document that shows you have a judgment in your favor against the tenants. Now, in order to have it attached to real property, you need to go take that and have it filed at the clerk and recorder's office, which is a different place. That's where they handle real property issues. The clerk you'll be dealing with is just a clerk for a small claims court and is a court clerk. So you may want to take that down there. That's not a very expensive procedure, and it does help you with regard to that.
If they don't own any property, is it worth, you know, getting that recorded?
Not now, no. But and what you may do is get a transcript of that judgment, just hold on to it, that you may want to file a later date, because that's what I was talking about. Sometimes, you know, people that are renting from you today, next year will be people who are buying their first piece of property, who are buying a house or putting something together. And I know you say, well, gee, Brad, they don't have much right now. Well, you know, a lot of people, they get some money from the folks, or they get land into a job where they can go buy something. And next thing you know, they own some property and you get a lien on it.
I see.
Another way you want to go for your money is you want to try to find out where they're banking. That's a question you want to ask them. And also you want to find out where they're working. If you find an account where they're banking, you can usually get most of the money out of the bank account. And if you find out where they're working, you can garnish their wages on a continuing writ of garnishment. That's what I would suggest you do at that point.
Brad, if you garnish someone's wages, you can take up to 25% of their wages. What you're going to do is you're going to serve the employer, and the employer then is obligated, but actually they're ordered with the writ to withhold money that's owed to you. And you can take up to 25% of their salary. You can also levy a bank account, what Brad suggested. You know, where they bank, you can go to the bank and withdraw their funds directly from their account, that will wake them up a lot, because what will happen is if you take all the money out of their account, all these checks and everything they've written on the account will start bouncing, and that'll shake them up a little bit.
Can I do that? Can I myself, or do I have to have a process server do that?
You're better to have the process server go serve it on the bank. What you're going to do is you're going to fill out a form that's called a writ of garnishment, and you can get those off the self-help website.
Yeah, Colorado Judicial Pages.
At the Colorado Judicial Pages. You can download that and fill it out. Now, here's what I mean. Supposedly, after the judgment's entered, they're supposed to go out to the clerk's room or out in the hallway or whatever and sit down with you and tell you how they're going to pay the judgment or where their assets are. You don't get that very often, okay? And so then what has to happen if you have to send out interrogatories, you have to find out where they're banking, or you have to ask the court to order them to answer certain questions about where they're banking. That may take a second visit down to the court for the judge to see that they didn't give you the information. here's a form I want it filled out where it would tell me where their assets are and what they are. When are you going into court?
It'll be the end of next month.
All right. I've got a list of questions that I use in what I call in Rule 69 interrogatories, which is a list of questions about where people's assets are, okay? So before we get off, I'm going to have Kevin take your name and number so we can send you that list. So,
okay.
Basic questions you can ask them about where your assets and where different things that you can use to find out where their assets are. You take the writ of garnishment where you find out where the assets are, and you fill it out, and it's a simple document. You just fill out that there's a judgment, and this is the date of the judgment. You get interest on the judgment at 8%, so you're going to be able to calculate the interest. You're going to be saying, here's how much they owe. And when you present that writ of garnishment to somebody who holds the debtor's asset, then you can go ahead and serve that on the bank, for instance. You just have a process server take it down and give it to the bank. The bank will take it, and then if there's any money in a bank account, you're going to get it. You do that same thing with an employer.
Question then, Brad. And any costs incur after the judgment, those can be added so that they have to reimburse me for my additional costs?
Right. The writ of garnishment form itself will have a place where you can add in the cost for collection of the judgment. And you can just add that in. You find out from the process server what they're charging to serve it, any other money you've spent, you can add that right into the writ of garnishment form.
That's good.
Does the court require that you have alternative dispute resolution before the hearing?
No, in a small claims court, I don't think they do.
Well, in Arapahoe County, they do.
You know what they might do, Joseph, is they might very well, when you first get in there, the judge might say, go out to the hallway or go into this room here and see if you guys can't work out this dispute. Okay?
Is that preferred to do? Is that the better way to go?
It is in two ways. First of all, you want them to admit that they're going to pay, agree they're going to pay. And the second thing is you can get them on the dispute and say, or at least admit to the judgment. But, when you go in to resolve the dispute, you walk in and say, okay, here's the damages. Do you guys want to pay it? I'm betting you got a good chance they're not even going to show up.
Yeah, I've heard that happens, So then I get a default judgment.
Right. You're still going to have to show the judge why you're entitled to it, but you're going to get a default judgment. And you'll be able to move on that. So that's what I'm betting you're going to find.
I got all the lease and all the paperwork and the receipts and pictures and everything. So I feel that I have a pretty solid case, but you never know until you get before the judge what he's going to say.
Well, we can talk about it, but I think you sound like you've got your act put together. Why don't I have Kevin take your number? And like I said, I'll send you the questions you do on collection, and also we can talk a little bit on the phone about how your case is put together, okay?
Okay, well, thanks very much for your help.
No problems. Just hold on, and we'll take your number. You're listening to the Bell and Polk Legal Show, 303-713-8255. If you have any questions, give us a call. We're happy to answer them. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Bell and Polk Legal Show. Brad Polk, Bob Leonard in the studio today. We're going to stay right with lines on your calls, 303-713-8255. We have Andrew from Colorado Springs. Andrew, you've got a problem with a friend not paying you back?
Correct. I lent a friend $10,000, and he signed a promissory note, and he said he would agree with payments of... He would pay me back within a year, and all he's giving me is $200, and that's inconsistent. Every other month to pay when he wants to pay.
Well, he's clearly in default of the promissory note, it sounds like.
Yes, absolutely.
There's no doubt on that. Have you talked to the friend at all? You know what's going on?
I've called him at least 100 times, and that's no exaggeration, and he hasn't returned any of my calls.
Yeah, a friend who's not a friend anymore, Andrew. That's what it is.
No, unfortunately.
Okay, you've got some choices on it. If it's a standard promissory note that you got from some kind of a publishing company or some other standard promissory note, it's going to have an interest provision. Did you have an interest provision in there?
Well, I just had a late fee. I didn't have an interest provision. I just said the late fee because he was a friend, and I, you know, he was going to invest and probably get this money back, but he never did, and so.
So you made.
I realized he was living in this expensive house, but I realized that he didn't own the house; he was renting the house. So it was just, it felt like I'd been scammed.
Well, I think you might have, you know, and in essence, you made the investment; he didn't. So your promissory note should have, if it doesn't have interest, it's got a late payment provision, so you ought to be able to go with the late payment provision. It'll also have a provision in there saying you can collect attorney's fees. The problem you've got is when you go to collect the attorney's fees and the promissory note, if the guy doesn't have money and you're chasing down, excuse my expression for this on people, but a deadbeat who's not paying and not collecting money, you got yourself in a situation. But if he's working, you can collect it. So what has to happen is on this, you're going to, I would be making a formal demand. And when on the formal demand to his address, maybe send a certified mail when he doesn't pay, I'd go ahead and file the claim. You can decide, Andrew, if you want an attorney to represent you, at which point you're going to have to pay an attorney, but you can collect that money back on the promissory note and in the judgment. And when the attorney gets the judgment, there's not going to be many defenses. It's going to be a pretty easy case. The attorney would take it into county court. Because county court jurisdictional limits are $25,000. So the attorney would fill out the necessary documents, take it into county court, get the guy served, and collect the money pretty fast. You live down in Colorado Springs, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
I have a question. What if he said he filed bankruptcy? I do have the checks that he sent me and the rally number or whatever is up on the check.
Well, and there you go. If he's the routing number and those type of things are important to have because now you know the bank where he's banking or he was at least banking at that time. You can also find out where he's working. Now, bankruptcy is a whole new story. Once somebody files bankruptcy and you get notice of bankruptcy, you cannot take any more actions to collect on any money they owe you. They're going to get a right to probably disclaim or nullify your debt unless – then you can show that the debt was a product of fraud or if there was any kind of security collateral on your promissory note. And I'm assuming there's no security or collateral on the promissory note.
No security, no collateral. I just, you know, was a friend of 40 years, fraternity brother, and I just, you know, he came to me, begged me and pleaded, and I finally just, you know,
gave in
the money.
So you're what's considered on the bankruptcy. You'd be considered a non-secured creditor. And as a non-secured creditor, you know, you said you thought you were scammed, but if you can't prove some kind of fraud that would be acceptable to the courts, you can always try. But basically, when you're going to the bankruptcy court, you're going to find that debt getting washed out and you're not going to be able to collect on it.
Well, I think it was fraud because he said it was multi-level marketing magazine that he was going to do, and he never did it. So, I mean, he said he was invested in that.
Well, in that case, Andrew, what I would think is that when you go to collect on the judgment or when you go to get a judgment, because you're going to have to get a judgment, start collection procedures, start those garnishment procedures, I would include a fraud claim in the collection of the promissory note. Now, it's going to complicate the case a little bit. But if you believe he exercised fraud in the inducement to get you to give the loan, I would include a fraud claim in the complaint. And then in the complaint with the fraud claim, I'd be saying that he's got to pay and I'd be doing that with an eye towards potential bankruptcy, so this guy still has to pay. Now, I would highly recommend, and we can talk to you about a lawyer down in the Springs that you can meet with. To represent you, but at the beginning, I'm happy to help you with figuring out what the complaint should be, showing you what the fraud claim should be, showing you how you do a basic claim for relief. You'd be the first claim for relief on the promissory note, second claim for relief for fraud in order to protect you against the bankruptcy proceedings or give you a chance that would make the debt non-dischargeable in bankruptcy. And see if
well,
you
get... I appreciate all that you can do. I listen to your show, every Saturday, and I was hearing the other show about 6 years. I mean, if he doesn't pay me in 6 years, then I'm just out of the money or what?
No. That promissory note's good. What he is he's in default, and that promissory note's still going to work. You're not going to have a problem with that. We're going to be able to help you with that. I think we can help you get an original complaint ready, and then we can also help you adding in a fraud claim and get you started down the road for court to make sure that you have a chance to collect on this debt. It's too bad that people don't pay their bills back, but this is one where we can probably help you on it. Don't you think, Bob?
Hey, for sure. I think, call us and we can help you get started.
Let me have Kevin take your number, okay?
Okay.
And then we'll talk to you this week to help you get things done. We'll give you a call, all right?
All right. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for listening to the Bell and Polk Legal Show. We've only got about a minute left before we're off the air, so we're just going to talk for a minute and discuss things. You know, it was nice to get a couple of calls where we had people who are looking for a way to pursue their rights. And they want to pursue their rights, and they're doing the things necessary to protect themselves. You need to talk to an attorney. We're here every weekend. We're here every Saturday morning. We come in at 7 o'clock. We go from 7 to 8. You have the Larry and Barry Real Estate Show coming on after us. These are great guys who know what they're doing. So don't change the dial. Stay and listen to them. And they have a great seminar coming up. You want to come to get that seminar. You want to see what they have to say in that seminar because it's going to be really important to be able to know what they're doing.
And also, Brad, we talked about the first part of the show about finding out if you have been affected by the Equifax breach of your information.
Okay. Make sure you look it up and give us a call if you need help. We got 5 seconds and we're out, folks. So have a good weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.